they wouldn't get a second one. Some kids ate the single marshmallow immediately. Some didn't even bother to ring the bell. Some kids restrained themselves by deliberately looking away, or by merely smelling the marshmallow, or poking it, licking their fingers. That kind of restraint indicates a capacity for deferred gratification, for rational control of emotion in decision-making. The interesting thing in the Stanford study is that those kids were tracked through later life. Researchers asked just about any question they could think of. How well did they do in school years later? How well could they cope with life's inevitable problems? What did they get on the SATs? What they found was that the kids who couldn't wait for the second marshmallow seemed to have more behavioral problems later. They had trouble maintaining attention. They had trouble maintaining friends. They didn't handle stress as well. The kid who could wait 15 minutes for a second marshmallow had SAT scores 200 points higher than the kid who could only wait 30 seconds. It may be that capacity for deferred gratification is set early in life, but it may be that we can cultivate it even now. In order to increase rationality in our decision-making, we should perhaps all learn to wait for that second marshmallow. In the next lecture, I want to reach into the philosopher's toolkit in order to hand you what I think is the most powerful thinking tool of all: conceptual visualization. The purpose of this course is to give you some tools, conceptual tools from the philosopher's toolkit. Tools for effective problem solving, for logical thinking, tools for rationality in general. In this lecture, I want to give you what I think is the most important tool of all. If I could hand you just one tool for logical thinking and effective problem solving, this would be it: the tool of visualization. Some of the lectures in this course work best if you can participate with pencil and paper along the way. This is one of those. If you can't work with pencil and paper right now, go on to another lecture and come back to this one. Visualization. I'll start with an example that I want you to do entirely in your head. You've got a long rectangular board. You cut it into two lengths, one of which is three times the length of the other. You now cut the smaller of those again into two pieces, one of which is twice as long as the other. The smallest piece is now 8 inches square. How long was the board you started out with? If you're like me, that's a medium grade problem. Not impossible, but it's easy to get lost. Now I want you to draw the board. Draw a long rectangular board. Divide it into two lengths, one of which is three times the length of the other. You'll draw a board with four equal parts. The smaller of those parts is cut into two pieces, one of which is twice as long as the other. If you draw it, your picture will probably show that smaller piece divided into three. The smallest piece of all is now 8 inches square. How long was the board? Looking at that picture, the answer is pretty obvious. The bit you divided into three has to be three times the length of your 8-inch square. So it's 24 inches long. The original board has to be four times that, 96 inches or 8 feet long. When you try to do it in your head, it's complicated, but not when you can see it, not even when you can see it in your mind's eye. When you try to do it in your head, it's mathy. You end up with all those symbols. But it's a lot less mathy, a lot less intimidating when you can see it. Then it's just a picture. If you're like me, pictures are a lot easier to think with than symbols are. I'm not out to teach you visualization. It's a tool you already have. What I want to do is to increase your respect for that tool, to use it more, to put it to work. There's something that people are extremely good at, but computers aren't. What we're particularly good at is pattern recognition. Think of your ability to recognize human faces. Newborns don't have any trouble recognizing a face as a face. We don't have any trouble recognizing the face of someone we know. We can sometimes do that even if we haven't seen the person for 20 years. Even if they're older, they've grown a mustache, and we see them fleetingly through a train window. Computer scientists have been trying to replicate that ability for decades. When it comes to information processing and pattern recognition, we have an amazingly fast and accurate resource at our disposal. Computers are faster and more accurate at all kinds of symbolic calculation. But when it comes to information processing and pattern recognition, nothing beats our visual system. Herbert Simon was a major figure in both computer science and cognitive science. In a paper called "Why a Diagram is Sometimes Worth 10,000 Words," he compares side by side a purely symbolic approach to a problem and an approach that uses a diagram. The symbolic approach runs to several detailed pages. The diagram, it turns out, is both more efficient and more convincing. Why is the diagram better? Simon thinks it's because we can see it, and seeing it allows us to exploit the visual thinking that's built in. Seeing it allows us to draw the immediate visual inferences that people are so good at. There's a long history of visualization in the philosopher's toolkit. At the core of the Republic, Plato outlines a theory of the relation between the visible and the intelligible world, between mere opinion and genuine knowledge. How does he try to get that across? Visually, with a diagram. It's called Plato's divided line, divided between the visible and the intelligible, further divided on each side between superficial understanding and a deeper grasp. One can almost see Plato scratching that line in the Athenian sand, and I'm sure he did. Of course, Plato wasn't the first. Before Plato came Pythagoras, philosopher, mystic, and mathematician. Everyone knows the Pythagorean theorem. For any right triangle, the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. Well, almost everybody knows it. At the end of The Wizard of Oz, the Scarecrow shows off his new brain by saying, "The sum of the square roots of any two sides of an isosceles triangle is equal to the square root of the remaining side." That's just so wrong in so many ways. No, for any right triangle, the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. The Pythagorean theorem is the shining gem in Euclid's geometry. In geometry, you may have proven the Pythagorean theorem from axioms, as Euclid did. But it's pretty clear that Pythagoras didn't think of it in terms of axioms. The source of his insight was almost certainly visual. In the last part of the lecture, I'll show you what Pythagoras' proof might have looked like. He almost certainly proved it by manipulating shapes with simply the power of visualization. Pythagoras' insight was literally something that he saw. That tradition of visualization continues through the history of thought. Another philosopher-mathematician, René Descartes, saw that there was a link between equations like y equals 2x squared plus 9x plus 3 and the beautiful arc of a parabola. By treating x and y as coordinates in a plane, algebra becomes geometrically visual. We still call those Cartesian coordinates. The conceptual tool? Visualization. Why does it help to work with pencil and paper rather than entirely in your head? One reason is cognitive capacity. There are just so many things we can hold in conscious attention at one time. I'll give you two numbers. I want you to multiply them in your head. The numbers are 9 and 7. That was easy, right? 63. Here are two more numbers. Now multiply these in your head. 27 and 54. Ouch. If you got that, I'm sure it took longer. The number is 1,458. Let me give you a third pair of numbers. 259 and 376. Unless you're a savant, that would take longer. It would hurt even more, and your error rate would rise. One of the most cited papers in psychology is a classic from the 1950s by George Miller, The Magical Number 7 Plus or Minus 2, Some Limits on Our Capacity for Processing Information. The thesis is that we can only manage about 7 pieces of information at one time, plus or minus 2. That's the limit of a phone number without the area code. Not surprisingly, the 7 plus or minus thesis depends on context, on what the 7 items are, and how you chunk information. The truth is, there's no single magic number that measures human cognitive capacity. But Miller makes his point. Our cognitive grasp is limited. It's probably much more limited than we'd like to think. You run up against that capacity when you try to multiply 2 3-digit numbers in your head. But now do something different. Write the 2 numbers down. 259 and 376. Multiply them on paper. That's going to be no problem at all. It'll take a minute, particularly since we're so used to grabbing a calculator, but with pencil and paper, it's easy. One benefit of writing it out is that it frees up cognitive load. If you assign the memory function to a piece of paper, you can let your brain concentrate on the manipulation function, like doing the actual multiplication. But visualization has benefits far beyond memory. Sometimes a visualization can practically solve the problem by itself. Here's a problem like that. There are 5 roads in Brown County. One runs from Abbeville to Brownsville by way of Clinton. One runs from Clinton to Derbyshire by way of Fremont. One runs from Fremont to Brownsville by way of Abbeville. That's all the roads in Brown County and all the roads in and out of those towns. Now let me give you 3 questions. Which towns have roads connecting them directly to 3 other towns? Which towns have roads connecting them directly to only 2 other towns? And how many towns do you have to pass through to get from Brownsville to Derbyshire? If you want to try those, press pause for a minute and start again when you're ready. If you've been paying attention to the theme of this lecture, you work those problems out by making a sketch. Indeed, I don't know why anyone would try to handle that kind of complexity without a sketch. 2 things happen with a sketch. The first is the simple matter of memory. Once you codify each piece of information in the sketch, you no longer have to keep it in short-term memory. Was that Abbeville to Clinton by way of Brownsville, or Abbeville to Brownsville by way of Clinton? The other thing that happens is that the sketch practically solves the problem by itself, because the information is all in the sketch. You can supply the information asked for just by looking at it. Which towns have roads leading directly to 3 other towns? Abbeville, Clinton, and Fremont. Which towns have roads connecting directly to just 2 others? Just Brownsville. How many towns between Brownsville and Derbyshire? 2, by 2 separate routes, though you could also go through 3 towns if you wanted to. The diagram itself embodies the information you need. The sketch itself solves the problem. You can use visualization for more abstract problems as well. Here's one. Each of 4 students, boys Jacob and Eli, and girls Lauren and Molly, got a different passing grade on a quiz, A, B, C, or D. Both boys scored lower than Lauren. Eli got a B. The problem gives us that information about kids and grades and asks us to answer some further questions. What grade did Lauren get? If the girls got both the best grade and the worst grade, what grade did Jacob get? If both boys had scored less than both girls, which of the initial statements I just gave you would have to be false? This is really a problem in information management. Use the information you have in order to squeeze out some more. And here again, visualization is the key. Even though the tie between people and grades is more abstract than roads between towns. What I just gave you is a common type of problem on standardized tests. It's known as a matrix problem because it's most easily solved with a particular visualization, a rectangular array called a matrix. The question's really about how two things align. Students Jacob, Eli, Lauren, and Molly on the one hand, and the grades A, B, C, and D on the other. Visualization turns that abstract alignment into a spatial one. A checkerboard matrix with the grades lined up along the top and the student names down the side. Spatial arrangements, spatial relationships, are easier to handle than abstract ones. You can see them. To solve the problem, we enter the information we have and read off the information we need. The three questions draw on the basic information we've been given. We get that down first. You should be aware that problems like this don't guarantee complete information. We want to tack down the information we have, see what possibilities that leaves open, and then turn to the particular questions asked. So, draw the grid, solve the problem, and come back. I'll be here working on it too. So let's think this through on the matrix. Start with the pieces of information that are most specific and seem to offer an immediate payoff. It was the second piece of information that we were given, but Eli got a B is the most promising. Let's use a dot to indicate positive information. That Eli got a B. We drop that in the matrix. We'll use an X to indicate negative information. Since Eli got a B, we know he didn't get some other grade, so X those out. Since we know that each student got a different grade, we know that no one else got a B. X those out. Our matrix just got smaller. We filled in a lot of information with that one bit. Now enter the rest of our information. Both boys scored lower than Lauren. Well, that doesn't tell us what both boys scored, but it does tell us what Lauren scored. Eli is a boy. Lauren did better than both boys, so Lauren had to get an A. Fill in the positive information. Now, fill in the negative information. That's all the information we have. But now it's visual. We can literally see what we know and what we don't. So what about those two other questions? If the girls got both the best grade and the worst grade, what grade did Jacob get? Since Lauren got an A, that would mean that Molly got a D. That would X out everything on the graph except for one slot left for Jacob. He'd have to get the C. And how about that last question? If both boys had scored less than both girls, which of the initial statements would have to be false? Well, it wouldn't have to be false that both boys scored less than Lauren. In fact, that would have to be true. But it couldn't be true that Eli got a B, unless more than one student got the same grade. So in that case, one of these initial pieces of information would have to be false, either that Eli got a B or that each student got a different grade. As I say, that type of problem is a favorite in standardized testing, but the key is simply a particular kind of visualization. With the right representation, the abstract becomes spatial. When you approach it visually, the problem is easy. People can train themselves in certain types of visualization, and even in certain types of seeing. I'm sure this is true of chess masters, who can see the significance of board patterns that are invisible to the rest of us. An easy example is what's called an open file, a sequence of squares that are vacant, open to a rook or a queen, for example, running from the player's side of the board toward the opponent's. What mastery demands is being able to visualize the board not in terms of where pieces are, but where they can go, or even in terms of fields of force. That leads me to another sense in which people talk about visualization. People sometimes talk about visualization as picturing what you want and claim that that'll help you get what you want. I'm not sure that'll work as a general technique. You can visualize being handed $1 million tomorrow all you like. I don't think that'll make it happen. But the story is told that the comedian Jim Carrey, still a struggling Canadian comic in the mid-1980s, wrote himself a check for $10 million for acting services rendered, dated years into the future. He carried that check for years as a focus, an inspiration, and a promise to himself. Mentally rehearsing a musical passage can indeed make you better at it. Mentally envisaging how your tennis serve should look can help you make it that way. But of course, mental rehearsal isn't the whole story. You have to pick up that tennis racket to put your visualization to work. Einstein was one of the great visualizers. He said he never thought in symbols or equations, that he thought in images, feelings, even musical architectures instead. The images, he said, came first. The words came later. In thinking through relativity theory, he envisaged lightning strikes hitting the ends of a moving train. He asked himself what the timing of the strikes would look like to someone inside the train and how they'd look to someone watching the train from the outside. That visualization is part of a thought experiment I'll explore in a later lecture. Einstein also employed much more abstract visualizations. He talks of gravity bending light, for example, and speaks of the curvature of space-time. It's become common to visualize those things in terms of a bowling ball on a rubber sheet. If you think of space as a square grid on a rubber sheet, what happens with light around massive bodies is something like what that grid looks like when you drop a bowling ball in the middle. The gravitational force makes straight lines curved, just as light will curve around a massive body. That image ties in with one of the first and most dramatic tests of some of Einstein's work. Suppose gravity does bend light. Then the observed position of some distant source of light, like the stars, should be different when there is and isn't a massive body between us and them, like the sun. If we could photograph the stars in an area of the sky when A, the sun is next to them, and B, when it isn't, and compare those photographs, we should be able to see if the theory is true. Unfortunately, you can't see the stars next to the sun. Sun's too bright. You can see them, however, during a total eclipse. In 1919, the British astronomer Arthur Eddington organized expeditions to Africa and Brazil in order to photograph the same portion of the sky before and during an eclipse. He was able to display the variance in the plates as a vindication of Einstein's vision. Philosophers of science still talk about that expedition, in part because Eddington may have glossed over some ambiguities in the data. What no one denies is how productive that visualization of curved space-time has turned out to be. The phenomenon is now called gravitational lensing. Sometimes, Einstein's visualizations were intended to explore even the limits of possibility. This is how Einstein himself portrayed one of his earliest visualizations. At the age of 16, he tells us, he tried to visualize what he would see if he pursued a beam of light with the speed of light. In that childlike thought experiment, he says, one can already see the germ of relativity theory. In that context, he again emphasizes visualization. Quote, discovery is not a work of logical thought, even if the final product is bound in logical form. There's an interesting footnote here. How did Einstein acquire his mastery of visualization? At 16, he was a student at the Aarau School. The teaching at Aarau was based on the work of an educational reformer named Pestalozzi. What Pestalozzi wrote was that the learning of numbers and language must be definitely subordinated. Visual understanding is the essential and only true means of teaching how to judge things correctly. An emphasis on visualization was an explicit part of Einstein's education. Let me return to Pythagoras. The Pythagorean theorem has been called the single most important result in all of mathematics. And yet Pythagoras's proof was almost certainly visual, using no math at all. First, the theorem the way Pythagoras probably saw it. For any right triangle, the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the squares on the other two sides. For square, don't think of mathy things like numbers raised to the power of 2. For square, just think square. The triangle in the middle is a right triangle, any right triangle. That large square on the upper right is the square on the hypotenuse. And what the theorem says is just that the area of that square is the same as the sum of the area of the other two squares put together, always. Pythagoras's visual proof probably went something like this. Take that square on the hypotenuse. Because it's a square, and because they're right triangles, we can fold 4 of these into that square, like this. Those cover the square on the hypotenuse, except for a little square in the middle, which you'll notice has sides that are the difference between the long side and the short side of our original triangle. When we put that in the square, we've covered the area of the square on the hypotenuse. What we want to show is that that area is the same as these other two put together. Now, because that's the area of the square on the hypotenuse, that area will remain the same even if we rearrange the pieces. Same area, rearranged. What we're out to show is that that area is the same as the area of these two squares put together. Take the little one. Its edge is the same as this edge over here. It'll cover that area first. Now take this one over here. This is the same as the long edge of our triangle, with this difference between the short and the long edge added in. That covers this area perfectly. There you have it. The square on the hypotenuse equals the sum of the squares on the other two sides. Nothing in that visual proof depended on what kind of right triangle it was. So it'll work for them all. Pythagoras himself saw the importance of the result. It is said that he sacrificed 100 oxen in celebration. What I hope you'll take from this lecture isn't so much a thesis as a tool, or increased respect for a tool you already have. Your thinking isn't limited to the space between your ears. There's no reason not to think of thinking as something that can happen using your eyes and with pencil and a piece of paper in front of you. Thinking can indeed be more powerful in that format. Mental visualization is very much like that. There's been a lot of work done in psychology on what's called mental rotation. In two-dimensional form, you are given two shape silhouettes and are asked whether it's possible to convert one into the other by rotating them. Which of the shapes on the right are rotations of the ones on the left? In three-dimensional form, you're given two three-dimensional shapes and asked whether the shapes are the same but somehow rotated. Which of the shapes on the right here are rotations of the ones on the left? It's been found that the time it takes someone to discover whether two rotated shapes are the same is directly related to how far you'd have to turn one in order to get the other. Just as it's faster to rotate something 90 degrees than a full 180 degrees, people are faster at recognizing something as rotated 90 degrees than a full 180 degrees. Another interesting result is that some of the same portions of the brain that are used in actual rotation are used in imagined or mental rotation. Seeing and imagining recruit some of the same crucial brain circuits. Did you get those, by the way? For the first one, rotation will give you the second and the fourth images. For the second one, it's the first and the third. The last interesting result is perhaps the most important for this lecture. Like all forms of visualization, mental rotation is something that gets better with practice. In the next lecture, we'll put these tools of visualization to work in examining the fundamental elements of all reasoning, the atoms of thought. I've talked about the power of visualization. In this lecture, I want to put visualization to work in examining some of the fundamental elements of all reasoning. You certainly know about atoms, and you can envisage them binding into molecules. The atoms of reasoning are concepts, the topic of this lecture. By the end, we'll be talking about how those atom concepts bind together into the molecules of reasoning, propositions. Concepts are the most basic elements in all thinking. Concepts are what we think with. In the Philosophical Investigations, the 20th century philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein says, "The aspects of things that are most important for us are hidden because of their simplicity and familiarity. One is unable to notice something because it's always before one's eyes." Something like that applies here. In this lecture, I want to emphasize some familiar facts and simple visualization techniques regarding the basic elements of thought. Simple, but fundamental. We'll rely on these facts and reach for these techniques repeatedly in further lectures. Let's begin with concepts. Everyone knows that concepts are ideas and that words represent those ideas. But people tend to think that concepts just float around in a random sea. They think of the universe of concepts as something like this: justice, presidential power, integrity, democracy, self-determination, convenience, economics, mercy, beauty, efficiency. Justice is a concept. Presidential power is a concept. Self-determination is a concept. Each of these is a word. Each word represents a concept, and the concepts are just concepts, all about the same. You can think of concepts as either things in your brain, your concepts, or as something we share as part of our culture, our concepts. But it's still true that many people think of them as just flotsam and jetsam, floating randomly in a mental or cultural sea. The fundamental fact I want to emphasize is that concepts do not float around independently. Physical atoms are organized by physical structure, the physical structure represented in the periodic table. As the atoms of thought, concepts come with their own inherent organizational structure too. Crucial to all effective thinking is an ability to visualize that inherent conceptual structure and to put it to use. What you actually heard a few minutes ago were words: justice, presidential power, self-determination. The words themselves are just combinations of sounds, or if written, certain combinations of marks. The concepts lie behind those words, not the words we use, but the ideas we express with those words. Is there a difference between words and concepts? Absolutely. The words are different from language to language. The concepts are not. It's frog in English, but frosch in German, and sapo in Portuguese, and grenouille in French. Different words, but just one concept. The recognition that concepts are distinct from words has been part of the philosophical toolkit at least since Aristotle in 350 BC. The Greeks supposedly called other people barbarians, including Egyptians, Etruscans, and Persians, because they sounded like they were babbling, bar, bar, bar. That makes the beginning passages of Aristotle's On Interpretation particularly remarkable. What Aristotle says is that words are symbols or signs for affections or impressions of the soul. Speech is not the same for all races of men, but the mental affections themselves, of which these words are the signs, Aristotle says, are the same for all mankind. We use words to express concepts, but words are different from the concepts they express. Simple as it is, that point turns out to be crucial in building good reasoning, in detecting bad reasoning, and in reasoning effectively together. Here's why. Because concepts and words are different, a single concept may be expressed by many different words. Even more importantly, very different concepts may lie behind the same word. Consider the word bank, for example, and listen to the following story. The plane's engine suddenly cut out. The pilot put his plane into a bank in order not to crash into the town below. He guided his plane safely to the riverbank so as not to hit the bank on Main Street. The word bank appeared three times in that story. You had no trouble in grasping the different concept between the same word, behind the same word each time. This is a harmless example, but there are a range of debates in which different concepts may lie behind a different word. Consider the word fairness. In a particular case, we may have to ask whether fair is being used to mean to all alike, or according to prior agreement, or to each according to his need, or to each according to his investment, to each according to his effort, or to each according to some standard of merit. Because different concepts may lie behind the same word, we may be talking past each other unless we identify the particular concept we have in mind by a particular word. Equality and liberty and terrorism are important words, but only because of the ideas behind them. Those are important ideas. All the more reason to be sure we can identify the specific concept at issue. Concepts don't just float around in a random sea. They come with their own relationships and inherent structure between them. Here are some questions, a simple example. Are frogs a kind of vertebrate, or are vertebrates a kind of frog? Are mammals a kind of squirrel, or are squirrels a kind of mammal? Easy. Frogs are a kind of vertebrate. It's not that vertebrates are a kind of frog. Mammals aren't a kind of squirrels. Squirrels are a kind of mammal. Those concepts have a kind of logical order, a relational structure. Words apply to concepts. Concepts apply to what? If we use the word things in full generality, recognizing not only physical things, but things like ideas, what concepts apply to are things. The concept of idea applies to ideas. The concept of frog applies to frogs. What we're talking about then is really a three-part relationship. The relationship between words, concepts, and the things those concepts apply to. Words express concepts. Concepts apply to things. We might say that words apply to things too, secondhand. Words express the concepts that apply to things. Philosophers speak of the totality of things that a concept applies to as its extension. What's the extension of a concept? just all the things that word applies to. We can express precisely the same thing in terms of set theory. What are all the things that the concept frogs applies to? The set of all frogs. Here's where a visualization comes in. Try to imagine all the frogs, past, present, and future, gathered into one corral. What that corral contains is the extension of the concept frog, the set of all frogs. In the same way, the extension of the concept of vertebrates is a corral with all vertebrates in it. The extension of the concept of idea, well, that's an interesting one. It's the set of all ideas, past, present, and future. Can you form a real physical corral of any of these things? No. But you can form a conceptual corral. You can gather them in thought. Venn diagrams are a way of visualizing the relations between concepts in terms of their extensions. So think of a corral for frogs, a corral with all the things the concept applies to. Now, without disturbing that first corral, think of another corral for vertebrates, inside of which are all the vertebrates, not only frogs, but sharks and squirrels and you. The only way to conceptualize that, to build a corral for vertebrates without disturbing the one you've already built for frogs, is to have one corral inside the other. Your original frog corral will be inside the larger vertebrates corral, one circle inside another. All squirrels are mammals? There will be a squirrel circle inside a larger mammal circle. All amphibians are animals, one circle inside another. We can think of what we're talking about as sets and subsets. The set of frogs is a subset of the set of vertebrates. Or as the extension of one concept, including the extension of another. Or as the scope of one concept, including the scope of another. Those all come down to the same relationship, and that relationship is captured by internal circles in a Venn diagram. Aristotle approached the relations of concepts in terms of categories and subcategories, genus and species. Today we think of genus and species as terms in biology. But in Aristotle, the idea is much more general. Some categories include smaller and more specific categories within them. A larger inclusive category is the genus. The smaller categories inside, specified by further differentia, are the species. That idea, too, amounts to circles inside circles, just like the circles in Venn diagrams. The diagrams are named after John Venn, a 19th century logician. There was another logician about the same time who came up with a similar idea, though he used squares. That other logician was Charles Dodgson. Charles Dodgson may not be a familiar name to you, but you already know quite a bit about him. In addition to his work as a mathematical logician, Dodgson wrote peculiar fantasy stories for a little girl named Alice. He used the pseudonym Lewis Carroll. There's a philosophical distinction that's important at this point, a distinction between the connotation and the denotation of a concept. That distinction has its roots in the medieval scholastics, but it appears with particular prominence in the work of John Stuart Mill. Denotation concerns the things that a concept applies to, its extension, just the things themselves. That's different from the connotation of words or concepts. The fact that concepts often label things with a particular flavor or emotional association. So here's a concept for you. Your grandmother's cookies. The denotation of that concept is its extension. The cookies themselves, whether you liked them or not. But phrases like grandmother's cookies, let alone grandmother's fresh-baked cookies, let alone grandmother's delicious fresh-baked cookies, clearly come loaded with a positive spin. That emotional take, whether positive or negative, is the connotation. Denotation is crucial to solid rational argument, reasoning in terms of facts about the things themselves. Connotation is the stuff of emotional persuasion, which we know can be far from rational. For that reason alone, it's important to be able to separate the two. So far, we've been talking about the organization of concepts and categories two at a time. But the relationships we're after form much larger structures as well. A second form of visualization takes us farther, visualization in terms of concept trees. There's an analogy between concept trees and family trees. If you drew a family tree for the descendants of Davy Crockett, You might have Davy as the trunk, his children as the first level of branches, their children as branches off of those, all the way down to the twigs, the living descendants of Davy Crockett. There are hundreds of twigs. A concept tree looks exactly like that, except the trunk will be the most general of a set of categories. The first branch will be a first division of subcategories. The next set of branches will be a subdivision of those, all the way down to the twigs. If you're in a situation right now in which you can work with a pencil in hand, that's the best. If you're in a situation in which you can't do that, you have to do it in your mind. If you can imagine drawing the concept tree, you'll be doing exactly what I'm after. Try drawing a concept tree for this set of concepts. Amphibians, vertebrates, squirrels, frogs, tree frogs, mammals, reptiles, turtles, snakes. Which of these concepts is the trunk of the tree? That means, which is the most general? Which is everything else a kind of? That's right, the trunk's going to be vertebrates, animals with backbones. All the rest are kinds of vertebrates. What's the next most general level? At that point, it'll branch into three: mammals, reptiles, and amphibians. Each is a type of vertebrate, none is a type of the other. Then on to the next level. You can test any concept tree for accuracy by starting at any twig and going back to the trunk. It should work like this. Tree frogs are a kind of frog, which is a kind of amphibian, which is a kind of vertebrate. If that works for every branch, you've captured the structure of that set of concepts as a tree diagram. Any set of related concepts can be visualized that way. Here's another one to work out on your own. What's the relationship between these concepts? Western religions, Christianity, Buddhism, religions, Eastern religions, Judaism, Protestantism, Presbyterianism, Confucianism, Zen Buddhism, Orthodox Judaism. Can you see that concept tree form as I say the words? If so, you're exercising precisely the kind of conceptual visualization I'm after. Western religions, Christianity, Buddhism, religions, Eastern religions, Judaism, Protestantism, Presbyterianism, Confucianism, Zen Buddhism, Orthodox Judaism. Our concepts aren't just flotsam in a mental or cultural sea. They come with inherent relationships that can be visualized in terms of Venn diagrams and concept trees. Concepts or categories are just the atoms of thought. Rationality really operates on the next level up, the molecules of thought. Those are called propositions. Let's start again with words. Words express concepts, but you can put words together to make sentences. And what sentences express are, there's no ordinary word for what it is that sentences express. We'll use a not-so-ordinary word instead. The philosopher's word is propositions. The basic idea is easy to get, but it can be hard to explain. A proposition is a claim or a statement or an assertion. It's what you say when you say something. Not the sentence you utter, not the sound you make, but the message you're trying to get across. Propositions are the information packets that we use sentences to express. Remember, concepts aren't just words, they're something behind the words, what the words are used to convey. Propositions aren't just sentences, they're something behind the sentences. There's something extra-linguistic that we use language to convey. Words and concepts don't map onto each other one-to-one. That was the lesson of the story about banks. Sentences and propositions don't map onto each other one-to-one either. Here's a sentence you might hear on the news. I want you to think beyond the sentence to the proposition being expressed. The CIA has succeeded in killing the leader of a major terrorist organization. Here's a different sentence. Different words, different order, different sentence. The head of one of the major terrorist organizations has been killed by the CIA. Do those two sentences express different propositions? Not unless you're extremely nitpicky. One sentence is in the active voice, one sentence is in the passive, one uses a leader instead of head of, a major terrorist organization instead of one of the major, but the message is the same. It's the same packet of information, the same proposition conveyed by two different sentences. How about these two? The deed was done in the billiard room with the rope by Colonel Mustard. Second sentence? Colonel Mustard did it in the billiard room with the rope. In the game Clue, those two sentences give precisely the same information. If you'd win with one, you'd win with the other. So different sentences can express the same proposition. It's also true that the same sentence can express different propositions. Suppose, for example, that we have a tape recording of you yesterday. When we play it back, we hear this sentence. I have a horrible headache. We also have a tape recording of your best friend 3 weeks ago. When we play it back, we hear this sentence. I have a horrible headache. Those are precisely the same sentence, word for word. But it's obvious that they're saying different things. One of them is about you. One of them is about your friend. One of them is about you yesterday. One's about your friend 3 weeks ago. Different people, different times, different headaches. The same sentence used to express different propositions in different contexts. Seeing through sentences to the propositions behind them is hard for some people. What we want to know is whether a sentence asserts something. So consider this one. The Surgeon General says that smoking's bad for your health. Does that sentence assert that smoking is bad for your health? It may say other things too. We want to know whether part of what it asserts is that smoking's bad for your health. No, that sentence just reports what the Surgeon General says. The phrase, smoking is bad for your health, appears there, but the sentence doesn't say that smoking is bad for your health. That's not part of what the sentence itself asserts. It just says that's what the Surgeon General says. You can't tell whether a sentence asserts that smoking is bad for your health by just trawling for that set of words. You have to understand what the sentence really says in order to know what proposition is being expressed. So listen to the following sentences and tell me which of these assert that smoking causes cancer. Number one, if smoking causes cancer, it's bad for your health. Number two, since smoking causes cancer, it's bad for your health. Number three, although smoking causes cancer, many people continue to smoke. If you said two and three, you're right. With since and although, two and three both commit themselves to the claim that smoking causes cancer. One says smoking's bad for your health if it causes cancer, but it doesn't commit itself to that if. That's not part of what it asserts. How about these? Either smoking causes cancer or car exhaust causes cancer. And this one? Smoking and car exhaust both cause cancer. The first one's an either-or. It doesn't commit to one side in particular. The other commits to both sides. Among other things, then, it does assert that smoking causes cancer. Here's why this is important. In everything we do, it's going to be what's behind the words that matters, not the words themselves. It's the ideas that'll matter, not the words we use for those ideas. It'll be the informational content of sentences that matter, not the sentences themselves. So when we talk about a solid argument or a rational hypothesis or a valid line of thought, it's going to be the propositions involved that are the focus of attention. Concepts are the atoms of all logic. Propositions are the molecules. How do the atoms go together to make those molecules? How do concepts go together to make propositions? Let me count the ways. I give up. Too many. But we can start with some simple cases. These are the simple cases that Aristotle started with when he invented logic. They're called categorical propositions because they combine two categories. Consider propositions that look like these. No frogs are philosophers. All neurologists are MDs. Some laws are unjust. Some inventions are not patentable. The first thing to notice is that all four of those propositions link just two categories. We know that categories can be visualized as the circles of Venn diagrams. That visualization technique scales up to diagrams not merely of concepts, but of their combination. All four of these propositions can be represented with overlapping circles for the two categories involved. Draw two overlapping circles. For the first proposition, mark the left circle frogs and the right one philosophers. That'll give you three internal spaces, an area of overlap, the frogs outside that overlap, and the philosophers outside that overlap. Logicians speak of logical space. This is a diagram in logical space. What that first proposition is telling us is that no frogs are philosophers. That means that one of these spaces is empty. Which one? No frogs are philosophers. A philosopher frog would be in that middle overlap area, a member of both circles. The proposition is telling us that there aren't any frog philosophers. It's telling us that that central area is empty. Black out the overlap, and you have a visualization of how those two concepts go together in that proposition. Take the second proposition. All neurologists are MDs. Here again, we start with overlapping circles labeled neurologists and MDs. Here, in this case, the proposition is that all neurologists are MDs. Here again, it's telling us that one of those three spaces is empty. Which one? That's right. It's telling us that the leftmost space is empty. So scratch it out. All neurologists are MDs. There are no neurologists outside the MD corral. The other two propositions are different. They're giving us positive information rather than negative. They're telling us that something is in a space. So draw overlapping circles for laws and unjust. The third proposition is that some laws are unjust. That means there's something in the overlap. So put an X there. That just means that there is something in that middle area. There's some unjust law. Finally, some inventions are not patentable. You figure that one out. With Venn diagrams, we can go from conceptual atoms to categorical propositions. Those will come in handy a few lectures down the line. Aristotle was the real inventor of logic, a logic that dominated Western philosophy for 2,000 years. It turns out that we can outline all the logic of Aristotle using the visualization you have at your fingertips. Throughout this lecture, we've been talking about categories. Thinking probably couldn't occur at all without that basic logical tool. These days, most tools come with warnings, and that applies to logical tools too. So here are some warnings regarding categories. It's the real things that we group in our categories. But our categories are of our own making. We group things together in terms of what we take to be important similarities. But we could be dead wrong about what's really important. There's no guarantee that our current concepts cut nature at its joints, in the wonderful phrase of the philosopher David Lewis. Consider the Linnaeus system of biological taxonomy, first set down by Carl Linnaeus in his Systema Naturae of 1735. That system divides all living things into phylums and classes, from there into orders, families, genus, and species. It's built on eyeball judgments of anatomical similarity. If what we're interested in is the pattern of evolution, anatomical similarity may not always be a very good indicator. Today, we can use DNA to track the point at which two species shared a common ancestor. In those terms, some species are more closely related than Linnaeus thought. Some species aren't so closely related. It turns out that the Linnaean categories didn't always cut nature at its joints. I started with a random handful of words. Here's another random handful. I want you to take a minute and sort these into three groups. The words are breaded, interior, facades, instinct, brains, fondue. Press pause, sort those into three groups, and come back. So how did you categorize those words? Maybe like this, the B words, breaded, brains, the F words, facades, fondue, the I words, instinct, interior. But then again, maybe you sorted them like this, the food words, breaded, fondue, the architectural words, facades, interior, the mind words, brain, instinct. You might have sorted them like this. The 6-letter words, brains, fondue. The 7-letter words, brains.